He will, from what he said already. They can prove Fagin an accessory before the fact and get the trial on Friday. And he'll swing in 6 days from this, by God.
You should have heard the people groan, said Chitling. The officers fought like devils, or they'd have torn him away. He was down once, but they made a ring round him and fought their way along. You should have seen how he looked about him, all muddy and bleeding, and clung to them as if they were his dearest friends. I can see him now, not able to stand upright with the pressing of the mob, and dragging him along amongst them. I can see the people jumping up and one behind the other, and snarling with their teeth, and making at him. I can see the blood upon his hair and beard, and hear the cries with which the women worked themselves into the centre of the crowd at the street corner, and swore they'd tear his heart out. The horror-stricken witness of this scene pressed his hands upon his ears, and with his eyes closed, got up and paced violently to and fro, like one distracted. While he was thus engaged, and the two men sat by in silence with their eyes fixed upon the floor, a pattering noise was heard upon the stairs, and Sykes's dog bounded into the room. They ran to the window, downstairs, and into the street. The dog had jumped in at an open window. He made no attempt to follow them, nor was his master to be seen. "What's the meaning of this?" said Toby, when they had returned. "He can't be coming here. I hope not."
"If he was coming here, he'd have come with the dog,"
said Kaggs, stooping down to examine the animal, who lay panting on the floor.
"Here, give us some water for him. He has run himself faint."
"He's drunk it all up, every drop," said Chitling, after watching the dog some time in silence. "Covered with mud, lame, half-blind. He must have come a long way."
"Where can he have come from?" exclaimed Toby. "He's been to the other kens, of course, and finding them filled with strangers, come on here, where he's been many a time and often. But where can he have come from first? And how comes he here alone without the other?"
"He," none of them called the murderer by his old name,
"he can't have made away with himself. What do you think?"
said Chitling. Toby shook his head.
"If he had," said Kaggs, "the dog would want to lead us away to where he did it. No, I think he's got out of the country and left the dog behind. He must have given him the slip somehow, or he wouldn't be so easy."
This solution, appearing the most probable one, was adopted as the right. The dog, creeping under a chair, coiled himself up to sleep without more notice from anybody. It being now dark, the shutter was closed, and a candle lighted and placed upon the table. The terrible events of the last 2 days had made a deep impression on all three, increased by the danger and uncertainty of their own position. They drew their chairs closer together, starting at every sound. They spoke little, and that in whispers, and were as silent and awe-stricken as if the remains of the murdered woman lay in the next room. They had sat thus some time, when suddenly was heard a hurried knocking at the door below.
"Young Bates!"
said Kaggs, looking angrily round, to check the fear he felt himself. The knocking came again. No, it wasn't he. He never knocked like that. Crackit went to the window, and, shaking all over, drew in his head. There was no need to tell them who it was. His pale face was enough. The dog, too, was on the alert in an instant, and ran whining to the door.
"We must let him in," he said, taking up the candle. "Isn't there any help for it?"
asked the other man in a hoarse voice.
"None. He must come in." "Don't leave us in the dark,"
said Kaggs, taking down a candle from the chimney-piece and lighting it with such a trembling hand that the knocking was twice repeated before he had finished. Crackit went down to the door and returned, followed by a man with the lower part of his face buried in a handkerchief and another tied over his head under his hat. He drew them slowly off. Blanched face, sunken eyes, hollow cheeks, beard of 3 days' growth, wasted flesh, short, thick breath. It was the very ghost of Sykes. He laid his hand upon a chair which stood in the middle of the room, but shuddering as he was about to drop into it, and seeming to glance over his shoulder, dragged it back close to the wall, as close as it would go, ground it against it, and sat down. Not a word had been exchanged. He looked from one to another in silence. If an eye were furtively raised and met his, it was instantly averted. When his hollow voice broke silence, they all three started. They seemed never to have heard its tones before.
"How came that dog here?" he asked.
"Alone. 3 hours ago. Tonight's paper says that Fagin's took. Is it true or a lie?
True.
They were silent again. Damn you all, said Sykes, passing his hand across his forehead. Have you nothing to say to me?
There was an uneasy movement among them, but nobody spoke.
You that keep this house, said Sykes, turning his face to Crackit, do you mean to sell me, or to let me lie here till this hunt is over?
You may stop here if you think it safe, returned the person addressed, after some hesitation.
Sykes carried his eyes slowly up the wall behind him, rather trying to turn his head than actually doing it, and said,
Is it the body? Is it buried?
They shook their heads.
Why isn't it? He retorted, with the same glance behind him. What do they keep such ugly things above the ground for? Who's that knocking?
Crackit intimated by a motion of his hand as he left the room that there was nothing to fear, and directly came back with Charlie Bates behind him. Sykes sat opposite the door, so that the moment the boy entered the room, he encountered his figure.
Toby, said the boy, falling back as Sykes turned his eyes towards him. Why didn't you tell me this downstairs?
There had been something so tremendous in the shrinking off of the three that the wretched man was willing to propitiate even this lad. Accordingly, he nodded and made as though he would shake hands with him.
Let me go into some other room, said the boy, retreating still farther. Charlie, said Sykes, stepping forward. Don't you know me? Don't come nearer me, answered the boy, still retreating, and looking with horror in his eyes upon the murderer's face. You monster!
The man stopped halfway, and they looked at each other, but Sykes's eyes sunk gradually to the ground.
Witness, you three! Cried the boy, shaking his clenched fist, and becoming more and more excited as he spoke. Witness, you three! I'm not afraid of him! If they come here after him, I'll give him up! I will! I tell you out at once! He may kill me for it if he likes, or if he dares, but if I'm here, I'll give him up. I'd give him up if he was to be boiled alive. Murder! Help! If there's the pluck of a man among you three, you'll help me. Murder! Help! Down with him!
Pouring out these cries, and accompanying them with violent gesticulation, the boy actually threw himself single-handed upon the strong man, and in the intensity of his energy and the suddenness of his surprise, brought him heavily to the ground. The three spectators seemed quite stupefied. They offered no interference, and the boy and man rolled on the ground together, the former heedless of the blows that showered upon him, wrenching his hands tighter and tighter in the garments about the murderer's breast, and never ceasing to call for help with all his might. The contest, however, was too unequal to last long. Sykes had him down, and his knee was on his throat when Crackit pulled him back with a look of alarm and pointed to the window. There were lights gleaming below, voices in loud and earnest conversation, the tramp of hurried footsteps, endless they seemed in number, crossing the nearest wooden bridge. One man on horseback seemed to be among the crowd, for there was the noise of hoofs rattling on the uneven pavement. The gleam of lights increased. The footsteps came more thickly and noisily on. Then came a loud knocking at the door, and then a hoarse murmur from such a multitude of angry voices as would have made the boldest quail.
Help! Shrieked the boy in a voice that rent the air. He's here! Break down the door! In the king's name! Cried the voices without, and the hoarse cry arose again, but louder. Break down the door! Screamed the boy. I tell you, they'll never open it! Run straight to the room where the light is! Break down the door!
Strokes, thick and heavy, rattled upon the door and lower window shutters as he ceased to speak, and a loud huzzah burst from the crowd, giving the listener for the first time some adequate idea of its immense extent.
Open the door of some place where I can lock this screeching hell, babe, cried Sykes, fiercely running to and fro, and dragging the boy now as easily as if he were an empty sack. That door, quick!
He flung him in, bolted it, and turned the key.
Is the downstairs door fast?
Double locked and chained, replied Crackit,
who, with the other two men, still remained quite helpless and bewildered.
The panels, are they strong?
Lined with sheet iron.
And the windows, too?
Yes, and the windows, damn you,
cried the desperate ruffian, throwing up the sash and menacing the crowd.
Do your worst. I'll cheat you yet.
Of all the terrific yells that ever fell on mortal ears, none could exceed the cry of the infuriated throng. Some shouted to those who were nearest to set the house on fire. Others roared to the officers to shoot him dead. Among them all, none showed such fury as the man on horseback, who, throwing himself out of the saddle and bursting through the crowd as if he were parting water, cried beneath the window, in a voice that rose above all others, 20 guineas to the man who brings a ladder! The nearest voices took up the cry, and hundreds echoed it. Some called for ladders, some for sledgehammers, some ran with torches to and fro as if to seek them, and still came back and roared again. Some spent their breath in impotent curses and execrations. Some pressed forward with the ecstasy of madmen, and thus impeded the progress of those below. Some among the boldest attempted to climb up by the waterspout and crevices in the wall, and all waved to and fro in the darkness beneath, like a field of corn moved by an angry wind, and joined from time to time in one loud, furious roar. "The tide!" cried the murderer, as he staggered back into the room and shut the faces out. "The tide was in as I came up. Give me a rope, a long rope. They're all in front. I may drop into the folly ditch and clear off that way. Give me a rope, or I shall do 3 more murders and kill myself." The panic-stricken men pointed to where such articles were kept. The murderer, hastily selecting the longest and strongest cord, hurried up to the housetop. All the windows in the rear of the house had been long ago bricked up, except one small trap in the room where the boy was locked, and that was too small even for the passage of his body. But from this aperture he had never ceased to call on those without to guard the back. And thus, when the murderer emerged at last on the housetop by the door in the roof, a loud shout proclaimed the fact to those in front, who immediately began to pour round, pressing upon each other in an unbroken stream. He planted a board, which he had carried up with him for the purpose, so firmly against the door that it must be matter of great difficulty to open it from the inside, and, creeping over the tiles, looked over the low parapet. The water was out, and the ditch a bed of mud. The crowd had been hushed during these few moments, watching his motions and doubtful of his purpose. But the instant they perceived it and knew it was defeated, they raised a cry of triumphant execration to which all their previous shouting had been whispers. Again and again it rose. Those who were at too great a distance to know its meaning took up the sound. It echoed and re-echoed. It seemed as though the whole city had poured its population out to curse him. On pressed the people from the front. On, in a strong, struggling current of angry faces, with here and there a glaring torch to light them up and show them out in all their wrath and passion. The houses on the opposite side of the ditch had been entered by the mob. Sashes were thrown up or torn bodily out. There were tiers and tiers of faces in every window, cluster upon cluster of people clinging to every housetop, each little bridge, and there were 3 in sight, bent beneath the weight of the crowd upon it. Still the current poured on to find some nook or hole from which to vent their shouts, and only for an instant to see the wretch. "They have him now!" cried a man on the nearest bridge. "Hurrah!" The crowd grew light with uncovered heads, and again the shout uprose. "I will give £50, cried an old gentleman from the same quarter, "to the man who takes him alive. I will remain here till he comes to ask me for it." There was another roar. At this moment the word was passed among the crowd that the door was forced at last, and that he who had first called for the ladder had mounted into the room. The stream abruptly turned as this intelligence ran from mouth to mouth, and the people at the windows, seeing those upon the bridges pouring back, quitted their stations, and running into the street, joined the concourse that now thronged pell-mell to the spot they had left, each man crashing and striving with his neighbour, and all panting with impatience to get near the door and look upon the criminal as the officers brought him out. The cries and shrieks of those who were pressed almost to suffocation or trampled down and trodden underfoot in the confusion were dreadful. The narrow ways were completely blocked up, and at this time, between the rush of some to regain the space in front of the house and the unavailing struggle of others to extricate themselves from the mass, the immediate attention was distracted from the murderer, although the universal eagerness for his capture was, if possible, increased. The man had shrunk down, thoroughly quelled by the ferocity of the crowd and the impossibility of escape.
But seeing this sudden change with no less rapidity than it had occurred, he sprang upon his feet, determined to make one last effort for his life by dropping into the ditch, and, at the risk of being stifled, endeavouring to creep away in the darkness and confusion. Roused into new strength and energy, and stimulated by the noise within the house which announced that an entrance had really been effected, he set his foot against the stack of chimneys, fastened one end of the rope tightly and firmly round it, and with the other made a strong running noose by the aid of his hands and teeth, almost in a second. He could let himself down by the cord to within a less distance of the ground than his own height, and had his knife ready in his hand to cut it then and drop. At the very instant when he brought the loop over his head previous to slipping it beneath his armpits, and when the old gentleman before mentioned, who had clung so tight to the railing of the bridge as to resist the force of the crowd and retain his position, earnestly warned those about him that the man was about to lower himself down, at that very instant the murderer, looking behind him on the roof, threw his arms above his head and uttered a yell of terror.
"The eyes again!"
he cried in an unearthly screech. Staggering as if struck by lightning, he lost his balance and tumbled over the parapet. The noose was on his neck. It ran up with his weight, tight as a bowstring and swift as the arrow it speeds. He fell for 5 and 30 feet. There was a sudden jerk, a terrific convulsion of the limbs, and there he hung, with the open knife clenched in his stiffening hand. The old chimney quivered with the shock, but stood it bravely. The murderer swung lifeless against the wall, and the boy, thrusting aside the dangling body which obscured his view, called to the people to come and take him out, for God's sake. A dog, which had lain concealed till now, ran backwards and forwards on the parapet with a dismal howl, and collecting himself for a spring, jumped for the dead man's shoulders. Missing his aim, he fell into the ditch, turning completely over as he went, and striking his head against a stone, dashed out his brains. Chapter 51. Affording an explanation of more mysteries than one, and comprehending a proposal of marriage with no word of settlement or pin money. The events narrated in the last chapter were yet but 2 days old, when Oliver found himself at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in a travelling carriage rolling fast towards his native town. Mrs. Maley and Rose and Mrs. Bedwin and the good doctor were with him, and Mr. Brownlow followed in a post-chaise, accompanied by one other person, whose name had not been mentioned. They had not talked much upon the way, for Oliver was in a flutter of agitation and uncertainty which deprived him of the power of collecting his thoughts, and almost of speech, and appeared to have scarcely less effect on his companions, who shared it in at least an equal degree. He and the two ladies had been very carefully made acquainted by Mr. Brownlow with the nature of the admissions which had been forced from Monks, and although they knew that the object of their present journey was to complete the work which had been so well begun, still, the whole matter was enveloped in enough doubt and mystery to leave them in endurance of the most intense suspense. The same kind friend had, with Mr. Losburn's assistance, cautiously stopped all channels of communication through which they could receive intelligence of the dreadful occurrences that had so recently taken place. It was quite true, he said, that they must know them before long, but it might be at a better time than the present, and it could not be at a worse. So they travelled on in silence, each busied with reflections on the object which had brought them together, and no one disposed to give utterance to the thoughts which crowded upon all. But if Oliver, under these influences, had remained silent while they journeyed towards his birthplace by a road he had never seen, how the whole current of his recollections ran back to old times, and what a crowd of emotions were wakened up in his breast when they turned into that which he had traversed on foot, a poor, houseless, wandering boy, without a friend to help him, or a roof to shelter his head. "See there! There!" cried Oliver, eagerly clasping the hand of Rose, and pointing out at the carriage window. "That's the stile I came over! There are the hedges I crept behind, for fear anyone should overtake me and force me back!
Yonder is the path across the fields, leading to the old house where I was a little child. Oh, Dick, Dick, my dear old friend, if I could only see you now.
You will see him soon, replied Rose, gently taking his folded hands between her own. You shall tell him how happy you are, and how rich you have grown, and that in all your happiness you have none so great as the coming back to make him happy too.
Yes, yes, said Oliver, and we'll take him away from here, and have him clothed and taught, and send him to some quiet country place where he may grow strong and well, shall we?
Rose nodded yes, for the boy was smiling through such happy tears that she could not speak.
You will be kind and good to him, for you are to everyone, said Oliver. It will make you cry, I know, to hear what he can tell. But never mind, never mind. It will be all over, and you will smile again. I know that, too, to think how changed he is. You did the same with me.
He said, God bless you to me when I ran away, cried the boy with a burst of affectionate emotion.
And I will say, God bless you now, and show him how I love him for it.
As they approached the town, and at length drove through its narrow streets, it became matter of no small difficulty to restrain the boy within reasonable bounds. There was Sowerberry's, the undertaker's, just as it used to be, only smaller and less imposing in appearance than he remembered it. There were all the well-known shops and houses, with almost every one of which he had some slight incident connected. There was Gamfield's cart, the very cart he used to have, standing at the old public-house door. There was the workhouse, the dreary prison of his youthful days, with its dismal windows frowning on the street. There was the same lean porter standing at the gate, at sight of whom Oliver involuntarily shrunk back, and then laughed at himself for being so foolish, then cried, then laughed again. There were scores of faces at the doors and windows that he knew quite well. There was nearly everything as if he had left it but yesterday, and all his recent life had been but a happy dream. But it was pure, earnest, joyful reality. They drove straight to the door of the chief hotel, which Oliver used to stare up at with awe and think a mighty palace, but which had somehow fallen off in grandeur and size. And here was Mr. Grimwig, all ready to receive them, kissing the young lady, and the old one too, when they got out of the coach, as if he were the grandfather of the whole party, all smiles and kindness, and not offering to eat his head. No, not once. Not even when he contradicted a very old postboy about the nearest road to London, and maintained he knew it best, though he had only come that way once, and that time fast asleep. There was dinner prepared, and there were bedrooms ready, and everything was arranged as if by magic. Notwithstanding all this, when the hurry of the first half-hour was over, the same silence and constraint prevailed that had marked their journey down. Mr. Brownlow did not join them at dinner, but remained in a separate room. The two other gentlemen hurried in and out with anxious faces, and during the short intervals when they were present, conversed apart. Once Mrs. Maley was called away, and after being absent for nearly an hour, returned with eyes swollen with weeping. All these things made Rose and Oliver, who were not in any new secrets, nervous and uncomfortable. They sat wondering in silence, or, if they exchanged a few words, spoke in whispers, as if they were afraid to hear the sound of their own voices. At length, when 9 o'clock had come, and they began to think they were to hear no more that night, Mr. Losburne and Mr. Grimwig entered the room, followed by Mr. Brownlow and a man whom Oliver almost shrieked with surprise to see, for they told him it was his brother, and it was the same man he had met at the market town and seen looking in with Fagin at the window of his little room. Monks cast a look of hate, which even then he could not dissemble, at the astonished boy, and sat down near the door. Mr. Brownlow, who had papers in his hand, walked to a table near which Rose and Oliver were seated.
"This is a painful task," said he, "but these declarations, which have been signed in London before many gentlemen, must be in substance repeated here. I would have spared you the degradation, but we must hear them from your own lips before we part, and you know why."
"Go on," said the person addressed, turning away his face. "Quick! I have almost done enough, I think. Don't keep me here."
"This child," said Mr. Brownlow, drawing Oliver to him and laying his hand upon his head, "is your half-brother, the illegitimate son of your father, my dear friend Edwin Leaford, by poor young Agnes Fleming, who died in giving him birth.
Yes, said Monks, scowling at the trembling boy, the beating of whose heart he might have heard. That is their bastard child.
The term you use, said Mr. Brownlow sternly, is a reproach to those who long since passed beyond the feeble censure of the world. It reflects disgrace on no one living except you who use it. Let that pass. He was born in this town.
In the workhouse of this town, was the sullen reply. You have the story there.
He pointed impatiently to the papers as he spoke.
I must have it here, too, said Mr. Brownlow, looking round upon the listeners. Listen, then, you, returned Monks. His father, being taken ill at Rome, was joined by his wife, my mother, from whom he had been long separated, who went from Paris and took me with her to look after his property, for what I know, for she had no great affection for him, nor he for her. He knew nothing of us, for his senses were gone, and he slumbered on till next day, when he died. Among the papers in his desk were two, dated on the night his illness first came on. Directed to yourself, he addressed himself to Mr. Brownlow, and enclosed in a few short lines to you, with an intimation on the cover of the packet that it was not to be forwarded till after he was dead. One of these papers was a letter to this girl, Agnes, the other a will.
What of the letter? Asked Mr. Brownlow.
The letter? A sheet of paper crossed and crossed again, with a penitent confession and prayers to God to help her. He had palmed a tale on the girl that some secret mystery, to be explained one day, prevented his marrying her just then. And so she had gone on, trusting patiently to him, until she trusted too far, and lost what none could ever give her back. She was, at that time, within a few months of her confinement. He told her all he had meant to do to hide her shame, if he had lived, and prayed her, if he died, not to curse his memory, or think the consequences of their sin would be visited on her or their young child, for all the guilt was his. He reminded her of the day he had given her the little locket, and the ring with her Christian name engraved upon it, and a blank left for that which he hoped one day to have bestowed upon her, prayed her yet to keep it and wear it next her heart, as she had done before, and then ran on wildly in the same words over and over again, as if he had gone distracted. I believe he had.
The will, said Mr. Brownlow, as Oliver's tears fell fast. Monks was silent. The will, said Mr. Brownlow, speaking for him, was in the same spirit as the letter. He talked of miseries which his wife had brought upon him, of the rebellious disposition, vice, malice, and premature bad passions of you, his only son, who had been trained to hate him, and left you and your mother each an annuity of £800. The bulk of his property he divided into two equal portions, one for Agnes Fleming, and the other for their child, if it should be born alive and ever come of age. If it were a girl, it was to inherit the money unconditionally. But if a boy, only on the stipulation that in his minority he should never have stained his name with any public act of dishonour, meanness, cowardice, or wrong. He did this, he said, to mark his confidence in the mother, and his conviction, only strengthened by approaching death, that the child would share her gentle heart and noble nature. If he were disappointed in this expectation, then the money was to come to you, for then, and not till then, when both children were equal, would he recognize your prior claim upon his purse, who had none upon his heart, but had from an infant repulsed him with coldness and aversion.
My mother, said Monks in a louder tone, did what a woman should have done. She burnt this will. The letter never reached its destination, but that and other proofs she kept in case they ever tried to lie away the blot. The girl's father had the truth from her with every aggravation that her violent hate, I love her for it now, could add. Goaded by shame and dishonour, he fled with his children into a remote corner of Wales, changing his very name that his friends might never know of his retreat. And here, no great while afterwards, he was found dead in his bed. The girl had left her home in secret some weeks before. He had searched for her on foot in every town and village near. It was on the night when he returned home, assured that she had destroyed herself to hide her shame and his, that his old heart broke.
There was a short silence here until Mr. Brownlow took up the thread of the narrative.
"Years after this," he said,
"this man's, Edward Leaford's, mother came to me.
He had left her when only 18, robbed her of jewels and money, gambled, squandered, forged, and fled to London, where for 2 years he had associated with the lowest outcasts. She was sinking under a painful and incurable disease, and wished to recover him before she died. Inquiries were set on foot, and strict searches made. They were unavailing for a long time, but ultimately successful, and he went back with her to France.
There she died," said Monks, "after a lingering illness, and on her deathbed she bequeathed these secrets to me, together with her unquenchable and deadly hatred of all whom they involved, though she need not have left me that, for I had inherited it long before. She would not believe that the girl had destroyed herself and the child too, but was filled with the impression that a male child had been born and was alive. I swore to her, if ever it crossed my path, to hunt it down, never to let it rest, to pursue it with the bitterest and most unrelenting animosity, to vent upon it the hatred that I deeply felt, and to spit upon the empty vaunt of that insulting will by dragging it, if I could, to the very gallows foot. She was right. He came in my way at last. I began well, and but for babbling drabs I would have finished as I began." As the villain folded his arms tight together and muttered curses on himself in the impotence of baffled malice, Mr. Brownlow turned to the terrified group beside him and explained that the Jew, who had been his old accomplice and confidant, had a large reward for keeping Oliver ensnared, of which some part was to be given up in the event of his being rescued, and that a dispute on this head had led to their visit to the country house for the purpose of identifying him. End of side 13. Side 14.
"The locket and ring," said Mr. Brownlow, turning to Monks.
"I bought them from the man and woman I told you of, who stole them from the nurse, who stole them from the corpse," answered Monks, without raising his eyes. "You know what became of them."
Mr. Brownlow merely nodded to Mr. Grimwig, who, disappearing with great alacrity, shortly returned, pushing in Mrs. Bumble, and dragging her unwilling consort after him.
"Do my eyes deceive me?"
cried Mr. Bumble, with ill-feigned enthusiasm.
"Or is that little Oliver? Oh, Oliver, if you knowed how I've been a-grieving for you!"
"Hold your tongue, fool," murmured Mrs. Bumble.
"Isn't nature nature, Mrs. Bumble?"
remonstrated the workhouse master.
"Can't I be supposed to feel? I has brought him up parochially, when I see him a-sitting here among ladies and gentlemen of the very affablest description. I always loved that boy as if he'd been my own grandfather,"
said Mr. Bumble, halting for an appropriate comparison.
"Master Oliver, my dear, you remember the blessed gentleman in the white waistcoat? He went to heaven last week in a oak coffin with plated handles, Oliver."
"Come, sir," said Mr. Grimwig tartly, "suppress your feelings."
"I will do my endeavours, sir," replied Mr. Bumble. "How do you do, sir? I hope you are very well."
This salutation was addressed to Mr. Brownlow, who had stepped up to within a short distance of the respectable couple. He inquired, as he pointed to Monks,
"Do you know that person?"
No,
replied Mrs. Bumble flatly.
"Perhaps you don't," said Mr. Brownlow, addressing her spouse. "I never saw him in all my life," said Mr. Bumble. "Nor sold him anything, perhaps?"
No,
replied Mrs. Bumble.
"You never had, perhaps, a certain gold locket and ring?" said Mr. Brownlow.
"Certainly not," replied the matron. "Why are we brought here to answer to such nonsense as this?"
Again Mr. Brownlow nodded to Mr. Grimwig, and again that gentleman limped away with extraordinary readiness. But not again did he return with a stout man and wife, for this time he led in two palsied women, who shook and tottered as they walked.
"You shut the door the night old Sally died,"
said the foremost one, raising her shrivelled hand.
"But you couldn't shut out the sound, or stop the chinks."
"No, no," said the other, looking round her and wagging her toothless jaws.
"No, no, no. We heard her try to tell you what she'd done, and saw you take a paper from her hand, and watched you too next day to the pawnbroker's shop,"
said the first.
"Yes," added the second, "and it was a locket and gold ring. We found out that, and saw it given you. We were by, oh, we were by, and we know more than that,"
resumed the first,
"for she told us often long ago that the young mother had told her that, feeling she should never get over it, she was on her way at the time that she was taken ill to die near the grave of the father of the child."
"Would you like to see the pawnbroker himself?" asked Mr. Grimwig with a motion towards the door.
"No,"
replied the woman.
"If he," she pointed to Monks, "has been coward enough to confess, as I see he has, and you have sounded all these hags till you have found the right ones, I have nothing more to say. I did sell them, and they're where you'll never get them. What then?"
"Nothing," replied Mr. Brownlow, "except that it remains for us to take care that neither of you is employed in a situation of trust again. You may leave the room."
"I hope," said Mr. Bumble, looking about him with great ruefulness, as Mr. Grimwig disappeared with the two old women, "I hope that this unfortunate little circumstance will not deprive me of my parochial office."
"Indeed it will," replied Mr. Brownlow. "You may make up your mind to that, and think yourself well off besides."
"It was all Mrs. Bumble."
"She would do it,"
urged Mr. Bumble, first looking round to ascertain that his partner had left the room.
"That is no excuse," replied Mr. Brownlow. "You were present on the occasion of the destruction of these trinkets, and indeed are the more guilty of the two in the eye of the law, for the law supposes that your wife acts under your direction."
"If the law supposes that,"
said Mr. Bumble, squeezing his hat emphatically in both hands,
"the law is a ass, a idiot. If that's the eye of the law is a bachelor, and the worst I wish the law is that his eye may be opened by experience. By experience!"
Laying great stress on the repetition of these two words, Mr. Bumble fixed his hat on very tight, and putting his hands in his pockets, followed his helpmate downstairs.
"Young lady," said Mr. Brownlow, turning to Rose, "give me your hand. Do not tremble. You need not fear to hear the few remaining words we have to say. If they have, I do not know how they can, but if they have any reference to me," said Rose, "pray let me hear them at some other time. I have not strength or spirits now."
"Nay," returned the old gentleman, drawing her arm through his, "you have more fortitude than this, I am sure. Do you know this young lady, sir?"
"Yes," replied Monks.
"I never saw you before," said Rose faintly.
"I have seen you often," returned Monks.
"The father of the unhappy Agnes had two daughters," said Mr. Brownlow. "What was the fate of the other, the child?"
"The child," replied Monks, "when her father died in a strange place, in a strange name, without a letter, book, or scrap of paper that yielded the faintest clue by which his friends or relatives could be traced, the child was taken by some wretched cottagers who reared it as their own."
"Go on,"
said Mr. Brownlow, signing to Mrs. Maley to approach. "Go on."
"You couldn't find the spot to which these people had repaired," said Monks. "But where friendship fails, hatred will often force a way. My mother found it after a year of cunning search. Aye, and found the child."
"She took it, did she?"
"No. The people were poor and began to sicken, at least the man did, of their fine humanity. So she left it with them, giving them a small present of money which would not last long, and promised more, which she never meant to send. She didn't quite rely, however, on their discontent and poverty for the child's unhappiness, but told the history of the sister's shame with such alterations as suited her, bade them take good heed of the child, for she came of bad blood, and told them she was illegitimate and sure to go wrong at one time or other. The circumstances countenanced all this. The people believed it. And there the child dragged on an existence miserable enough even to satisfy us, until a widow lady, residing then at Chester, saw the girl by chance, pitied her, and took her home. There was some cursed spell, I think, against us, for in spite of all our efforts, she remained there, and was happy. I lost sight of her 2 or 3 years ago, and saw her no more until a few months back.
Do you see her now?
Yes, leaning on your arm.
But not the less my niece, cried Mrs. Maylie, folding the fainting girl in her arms. Not the less my dearest child. I would not lose her now for all the treasures of the world. My sweet companion, my own dear girl, the only friend I ever had, cried Rose, clinging to her. The kindest, best of friends. My heart will burst. I cannot bear all this. You have borne more, and have been through all the best and gentlest creature that ever shed happiness on everyone she knew, said Mrs. Maylie, embracing her tenderly. Come, come, my love. Remember who this is who waits to clasp you in his arms, poor child. See here. Look, look, my dear. Not aunt, cried Oliver, throwing his arms about her neck. I'll never call her aunt. Sister, my own dear sister, that something taught my heart to love so dearly from the first. Rose, dear, darling Rose. Let the tears which fell, and the broken words which were exchanged in the long, close embrace between the orphans, be sacred. A father, sister, and mother were gained and lost in that one moment. Joy and grief were mingled in the cup, but there were no bitter tears, for even grief itself arose, so softened and clothed in such sweet and tender recollections, that it became a solemn pleasure and lost all character of pain. They were a long, long time alone. A soft tap at the door at length announced that someone was without. Oliver opened it, glided away, and gave place to Harry Maylie. "I know it all," he said, taking a seat beside the lovely girl. "Dear Rose, I know it all. I am not here by accident," he added after a lengthened silence. "Nor have I heard all this tonight, for I knew it yesterday, only yesterday. Do you guess that I have come to remind you of a promise?" "Stay," said Rose. "You do know all, all. You gave me leave at any time within a year to renew the subject of our last discourse." "I did. Not to press you to alter your determination," pursued the young man, "but to hear you repeat it if you would. I was to lay whatever of station or fortune I might possess at your feet. And if you still adhered to your former determination, I pledged myself by no word or act to seek to change it. The same reasons which influenced me then will influence me now," said Rose firmly. "If I ever owed a strict and rigid duty to her, whose goodness saved me from a life of indigence and suffering, when should I ever feel it, as I should tonight?" "It is a struggle," said Rose, "but one I am proud to make. It is a pang, but one my heart shall bear." "The disclosure of tonight," Harry began. "The disclosure of tonight," replied Rose softly, "leaves me in the same position with reference to you as that in which I stood before."
"You harden your heart against me, Rose," urged her lover.
"Oh, Harry, Harry," said the young lady, bursting into tears, "I wish I could and spare myself this pain."
"Then why inflict it on yourself?" said Harry, taking her hand.
"Think, dear Rose, think what you have heard tonight." "And what have I heard? What have I heard?" cried Rose. "That a sense of his deep disgrace so worked upon my own father that he shunned all. There, you have said enough, Harry. We have said enough."
"Not yet.
"Not yet," said the young man, detaining her as she rose. "My hopes, my wishes, prospects, feeling, every thought in life except my love for you, have undergone a change. I offer you now no distinction among a bustling crowd, no mingling with a world of malice and detraction, where the blood is called into honest cheeks by aught but real disgrace and shame, but a home, a heart and home. Yes, dearest Rose, and those alone are all I have to offer." "What do you mean?" she faltered. "I mean but this, that when I left you last, I left you with a firm determination to level all fancied barriers between yourself and me, resolved that if my world could not be yours, I would make yours mine, that no pride of birth should curl the lip at you, for I would turn from it. This I have done. Those who have shrunk from me because of this have shrunk from you, and proved you so far right. Such power and patronage, such relatives of influence and rank, as smiled upon me then, look coldly now. But there are smiling fields and waving trees in England's richest county. And by one village church, mine, Rose, my own, there stands a rustic dwelling which you can make me prouder of than all the hopes I have renounced, measured a thousandfold. This is my rank and station now, and here I lay it down."
"It's a trying thing waiting supper for lovers," said Mr. Grimwig, waking up and pulling his pocket handkerchief from over his head. Truth to tell, the supper had been waiting a most unreasonable time. Neither Mrs. Maylie, nor Harry, nor Rose, who all came in together, could offer a word in extenuation. "I had serious thoughts of eating my head tonight," said Mr. Grimwig, "for I began to think I should get nothing else. I'll take the liberty, if you'll allow me, of saluting the bride that is to be." Mr. Grimwig lost no time in carrying this notice into effect upon the blushing girl, and the example, being contagious, was followed by both the doctor and Mr. Brownlow. Some people affirm that Harry Maylie had been observed to set it, originally, in a dark room adjoining. But the best authorities consider this downright scandal, he being young and a clergyman.
"Oliver, my child," said Mrs. Maylie, "where have you been? And why do you look so sad? There are tears stealing down your face at this moment. What is the matter?"
"It is a world of disappointment, often to the hopes we most cherish, and hopes that do our nature the greatest honour. Poor Dick was dead." Chapter 52. Fagin's Last Night Alive. The court was paved from floor to roof with human faces. Inquisitive and eager eyes peered from every inch of space. From the rail before the dock, away into the sharpest angle of the smallest corner in the galleries, all looks were fixed upon one man, the Jew. Before him and behind, above, below, on the right and on the left, he seemed to stand surrounded by a firmament, all bright with gleaming eyes. He stood there, in all this glare of living light, with one hand resting on the wooden slab before him, the other held to his ear, and his head thrust forward to enable him to catch with greater distinctness every word that fell from the presiding judge, who was delivering his charge to the jury. At times he turned his eyes sharply upon them to observe the effect of the slightest featherweight in his favour, and when the points against him were stated with terrible distinctness, looked towards his counsel in mute appeal that he would, even then, urge something in his behalf. Beyond these manifestations of anxiety, he stirred not hand or foot. He had scarcely moved since the trial began, and now that the judge ceased to speak, he still remained in the same strained attitude of close attention, with his gaze bent on him, as though he listened still. A slight bustle in the court recalled him to himself. Looking round, he saw that the jurymen had turned together to consider their verdict. As his eyes wandered to the gallery, He could see the people rising above each other to see his face, some hastily applying their glasses to their eyes, and others whispering their neighbours with looks expressive of abhorrence. A few there were who seemed unmindful of him and looked only to the jury in impatient wonder how they could delay. But in no one face, not even among the women, of whom there were many there, could he read the faintest sympathy with himself or any feeling but one of all-absorbing interest that he should be condemned. As he saw all this in one bewildered glance, the death-like stillness came again. And looking back, he saw that the jurymen had turned towards the judge. Hush! They only sought permission to retire. He looked wistfully into their faces one by one when they passed out, as though to see which way the greater number leant. But that was fruitless. The jailer touched him on the shoulder. He followed mechanically to the end of the dock and sat down on a chair. The man pointed it out, or he would not have seen it. He looked up into the gallery again. Some of the people were eating, and some fanning themselves with handkerchiefs, for the crowded place was very hot. There was one young man sketching his face in a little notebook. He wondered whether it was like, and looked on when the artist broke his pencil point and made another with his knife, as any idle spectator might have done. In the same way, when he turned his eyes towards the judge, his mind began to busy itself with the fashion of his dress, and what it cost, and how he put it on. There was an old fat gentleman on the bench, too, who had gone out some half an hour before, and now come back. He wondered within himself whether this man had been to get his dinner, what he had had, and where he had had it, and pursued this train of careless thought until some new object caught his eye and roused another. Not that all this time his mind was for an instant free from one oppressive, overwhelming sense of the grave that opened at his feet. It was ever present to him, but in a vague and general way, and he could not fix his thoughts upon it. Thus, even while he trembled and turned burning hot at the idea of speedy death, he fell to counting the iron spikes before him, and wondering how the head of one had been broken off, and whether they would mend it or leave it as it was. Then he thought of all the horrors of the gallows and the scaffold, and stopped to watch a man sprinkling the floor to cool it, and then went on to think again. At length there was a cry of silence and a breathless look from all towards the door. The jury returned and passed him close. He could glean nothing from their faces. They might as well have been of stone. Perfect stillness ensued. Not a rustle, not a breath. Guilty. The building rang with a tremendous shout, and another, and another, and then it echoed loud groans, then gathered strength as they swelled out like angry thunder. It was a peal of joy from the populace outside, greeting the news that he would die on Monday. The noise subsided. And he was asked if he had anything to say why sentence of death should not be passed upon him. He had resumed his listening attitude and looked intently at his questioner while the demand was made. But it was twice repeated before he seemed to hear it, and then he only muttered that he was an old man, an old man, an old man, and so, dropping into a whisper, was silent again. The judge assumed the black cap, and the prisoner still stood with the same air and gesture. A woman in the gallery uttered some exclamation called forth by this dread solemnity. He looked hastily up, as if angry at the interruption, and bent forward yet more attentively. The address was solemn and impressive, the sentence fearful to hear. But he stood like a marble figure without the motion of a nerve. His haggard face was still thrust forward, his under jaw hanging down, and his eyes staring out before him, when the jailer put his hand upon his arm and beckoned him away. He gazed stupidly about him for an instant, and obeyed. They led him through a paved room under the court, where some prisoners were waiting till their turns came, and others were talking to their friends who crowded round a grate which looked into the open yard. There was nobody there to speak to him, but as he passed, the prisoners fell back to render him more visible to the people who were clinging to the bars, and they assailed him with opprobrious names, and screeched and hissed. He shook his fist and would have spat upon them, but his conductors hurried him on through a gloomy passage lighted by a few dim lamps into the interior of the prison. Here he was searched, that he might not have about him the means of anticipating the law. This ceremony performed, they led him to one of the condemned cells, and left him there, alone. He sat down on a stone bench opposite the door, which served for a seat and bedstead, and casting his bloodshot eyes upon the ground, tried to collect his thoughts. After a while, he began to remember a few disjointed fragments of what the judge had said, though it had seemed to him at the time that he could not hear a word. These gradually fell into their proper places, and by degrees suggested more, so that in a little time he had the whole, almost as it was delivered, to be hanged by the neck till he was dead. That was the end. To be hanged by the neck till he was dead. As it came on very dark, he began to think of all the men he had known who had died upon the scaffold, some of them through his means. They rose up in such quick succession that he could hardly count them. He had seen some of them die, and had joked, too, because they died with prayers upon their lips. With what a rattling noise the drop went down, and how suddenly they changed from strong and vigorous men to dangling heaps of clothes. Some of them might have inhabited that very cell, sat upon that very spot. It was very dark. Why didn't they bring a light? The cell had been built for many years. Scores of men must have passed their last hours here. It was like sitting in a vault strewn with dead bodies. The cap, the noose, the pinioned arms, the faces that he knew even beneath that hideous veil. Light! Light! At length, when his hands were raw with beating against the heavy door and walls, two men appeared, one bearing a candle, which he thrust into an iron candlestick fixed against the wall, the other dragging in a mattress on which to pass the night, for the prisoner was to be left alone no more. Then came night, dark, dismal, silent night. Other watchers are glad to hear the church clocks strike, for they tell of life and coming day. To the Jew they brought despair. The boom of every iron bell came laden with the one deep hollow sound, death. What availed the noise and bustle of cheerful morning which penetrated even there to him? It was another form of knell, with mockery added to the warning. The day passed off. Day? There was no day. It was gone as soon as come, and night came on again, night so long and yet so short, long in its dreadful silence, and short in its fleeting hours. At one time he raved and blasphemed, and at another howled and tore his hair. Venerable men of his own persuasion had come to pray beside him, but he had driven them away with curses. They renewed their charitable efforts, and he beat them off. Saturday night. He had only one night more to live. And as he thought of this, the day broke. Sunday. It was not until the night of this last awful day that a withering sense of his helpless, desperate state came in its full intensity upon his blighted soul. Not that he had ever held any defined or positive hope of mercy, but that he had never been able to consider more than the dim probability of dying so soon. He had spoken little to either of the two men, who relieved each other in their attendance upon him, and they, for their parts, made no effort to rouse his attention. He had sat there, awake, but dreaming. Now he started up every minute, and with gasping mouth and burning skin, hurried to and fro in such a paroxysm of fear and wrath that even they, used to such sights, recoiled from him with horror. He grew so terrible at last in all the tortures of his evil conscience that one man could not bear to sit there eyeing him alone, and so the two kept watch together. He cowered down upon his stone bed and thought of the past. He had been wounded with some missiles from the crowd on the day of his capture, and his head was bandaged with a linen cloth. His red hair hung down upon his bloodless face. His beard was torn and twisted into knots. His eyes shone with a terrible light. His unwashed flesh crackled with the fever that burnt him up. 8, 9, 10. If it was not a trick to frighten him, and those were the real hours treading on each other's heels, where would he be when they came round again? 11. Another struck before the voice of the